The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Sam Livingston, and I am filling in today for Mr. Stephen Fleury, and thankful for the opportunity to do so. It will be a bit of a grab bag today. We'll be covering quite a few things. I wanted to go back and talk a little bit more about some of those Supreme Court decisions that were made last week. Mr. Fleury touched on a few of those, and then there's another big one that should be coming up tomorrow. Then we'll talk a little bit more about some developments in the deep state. Haven't been able to get to that as much with all of the rioting going on and coronavirus finally creeping back into the news. And hopefully, if there's time, I'd like to conclude by going through a book about community organizing and just to help give us some insight into really how the mob thinks. Well, I'll start with just going back through the decision that was made last Monday, or sorry, this would be two Mondays ago. This was June 15th, and that was the Supreme Court decision, a landmark decision that prohibited employers from discriminating based on a person's sexual orientation. And like I said, Mr. Fleury touched on that. I think I've got a few different angles that I'd like to add on there. I think one big thing that was frustrating in reading this decision was to hear how much the left said, well, this is the decision that Antonin Scalia would have wanted. Gorsuch was Scalia's replacement, and he was just being a good textualist and reading the statute the way Scalia would have wanted to. And it's hilarious to see them go and use Scalia as their defense when there's probably no justice on the Supreme Court in the last, I don't know, 50 years. You can't put a time frame on it, that they have hated probably more than Antonin Scalia. Again, just to review, it was a 6-3 victory, quote-unquote, for the LGBT community, and that was with the two conservative judges, Neil Gorsuch and Justice Roberts, siding with the majority. And again, the shocker was Gorsuch writing the majority opinion there. The New York Times said this was an unexpected victory, even after President Trump transformed the court with his two appointments. They said it was a surprise. Some of the other comments, you just wonder, well, these are the Supreme Court reporters for these organizations, and it's almost, well, they don't fundamentally understand how it works, or they do, and they just want to bring it down. The New York Times says, the Supreme Court is generally not very far out of step with popular opinion. Well, that is why we have a legislature. That's why we have a Congress. People vote. And the Supreme Court is not there to decide popular opinion. I think a lot of people would disagree with the opinions of a lot of those justices. A lot of them are from a different generation as well. The New York Times says, the decision will allow people who say they were discriminated against in the workplace based on their sexual orientation or gender identity to file lawsuits, just as people claiming race and sex discrimination may. Justice Alito, he wrote the dissent with Clarence Thomas. He said, there is only one word for what the court has done today, legislation. So never mind popular opinion, never mind whether or not you agree with the decision. It's about the process. How are these laws made? And the Supreme Court just took it upon itself to make this decision. CNN was ecstatic over Gorsuch's majority opinion. CNN writes, Gorsuch simply was showcasing his fidelity to rules of statutory interpretation, relying on the plain text of the law that were championed by the late Justice Antonin Scalia. This is what Scalia would have wanted. And when you look at what Gorsuch did, it is the, I don't think you can get any further away from what Scalia would have said or how he would have approached this. Like Mr. Fleury covered, this revolved around the definition of the word sex and the way that word was used in 1964 and what 50 years of interpretation or people interpreting that judgment thought that it meant. And then Gorsuch reads it and he says, well, I'm a textualist. And the definition of the word sex by 2020 values is sexual orientation, who you're attracted to, blah, 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 blah. And he's making it up as he goes, because if that's the way you reason, well, all it takes is updating the dictionary and you get your way. This was a law clerk who works for Clarence Thomas. She wrote, this was not judging, this was legislating, a brute force attack on our constitutional system. In Alito's dissent, he says, by proclaiming that sexual orientation and gender identity are not relevant to employment decisions, the court updates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act from 1964 to reflect what it regards as 2020 value. So reading the modern definition into these old laws, taking it out of its historical context, redefining the words, and updating it to fit 2020 values. That is not the job of the court. Gorsuch argued his position in 30 pages, and if you see these opinion pages, they're not even half filled. The margins are massive, probably so people can take notes. He does that in 30 pages, undoes 50 years of precedent, and that's all it takes. Alito's dissent, along with Brett Kavanaugh's, they make up over 160 pages explaining why Gorsuch's decision is bogus. I went through some of that, and it was pretty funny and sad how the majority's defense, it was all of these hypothetical scenarios. They didn't really give anything concrete. It was, well, what if this happens and what if this happens? Whereas you look at what Alito did, and Kavanaugh's dissent was pretty much just an apology letter. Alito's dissent is the one that's more important. And he goes through and he gives case examples and he gives real world examples. The Wall Street Journal said this was another win for Elisa Kagan. She is a liberal justice on that court. I wanted to find here a quote from Alito's dissent just to explain the repercussions of this decision. There are some states that had already made this decision within the state, and there were a lot of states that didn't have this decision. So this court made it the law of the land. This is from Alito's dissent. He says, briefs filed by a wide range of religious groups, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, express deep concern that the position now adopted by the court will trigger open conflict with faith-based employment practices of numerous churches, synagogues, mosques, and other religious institutions. They argue that religious organizations need employees who actually live the faith, and that compelling a religious organization to employ individuals whose conduct flouts the tenets of the organization's faith forces the group to communicate an objectionable message. So what do you do if you are a Catholic-run school and this teacher comes out as a homosexual and that is against your religious teachings? Well, according to the ruling now, you cannot fire that person simply because they are a homosexual. Alito continues, this problem is perhaps most acute when it comes to the employment of teachers, like I just explained. Thus, if a religious school teaches that sex outside marriage and sex reassignment procedures are immoral, the message may be lost if the school employs a teacher who is in a same-sex relationship or has undergone or is undergoing sex reassignment. Yet today's decision may lead to Title VII claims by such teachers and applicants for employment. He later says, this will have a severe impact on their ability to honor their deeply held religious beliefs. So what this decision does is force it on these institutions that don't believe it. And someone comes in for an interview and say they don't get the job, and they just go out and say, well, he didn't do it because I'm a transgender. He didn't hire me because I'm a homosexual. And sure enough, inevitably what's going to happen is lots and lots of lawsuits. I mean, they already do this, these activists. I think Colorado was one example where there was the case of that baker who didn't want to put two men having a wedding on top of the wedding cake, and they sued him. And he just said, well, why can't you go to the baker down the road? Why do you have to pick my baker or my bakery, and you can't force me to do something against my religious beliefs? Well, that was a lawsuit, and I think, I can't remember how that ended up. I think that also made it to the Supreme Court. I need to look back on that. I think that was around 2016, 2017. So you have last week the Supreme Court legislating, and then 2 days later, they take over the executive branch with this decision on Obama's DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And this decision was made on Wednesday. If you remember a little bit of the history here, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, this was a program that Obama created by fiat. He couldn't get Congress to create it. And you can go back and you can read his quotes about it. He said, well, I don't have the power to do this. I have to wait for Congress. I think there's one quote in here. I need to find it. He literally says, I am not a king. It's just not true that I can go and do things on my own. He said that prior to 2012. Then we get to 2012 and he makes the rule himself. And it's an illegal rule because Congress already has laws that define immigration. We already have immigration laws and statutes that Congress has passed and has made. And what Obama did was he changed the status of those immigrants or those children that were brought to the United States and said, well, they're not, I can't remember the exact term, illegal aliens or whatever it was. And he changed that in violation of the statutes that were already there. So this program is illegal. And it goes on for 5 years. You get to 2017, President Trump, he's in office. He says, get rid of this. And what happens is the states that want it end up suing the Trump administration. Okay, well, how do you sue the administration? How do you sue the executive? If they created it by fiat, they should be able to take it away by fiat. Well, they say President Trump didn't have a good enough reason for getting rid of DACA. So he was in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, which essentially means you have to have a good reason for doing something. You have to explain yourself for, you know, why this decision is right. So President Obama didn't have to meet any of those criteria because when he did it, it was illegal and in violation of that. President Trump, in order to undo it, does have to meet those rigorous standards. Now, this decision was made last Wednesday, and it was only Justice Roberts in this case that broke his conservative mold, quote unquote, and went over to the far left judges and sided with them that President Trump did not explain in a good enough way why he should get rid of DACA. And he doesn't have to explain it. The executive created it, and the executive can take it away. Well, not so, says the Roberts court. Justice Thomas was beside himself. He could not understand even why this was an argument. He says he called it a mystifying determination. He wrote DACA was unlawful from its inception. From his dissent, he says the majority's holding creates perverse incentives, particularly for outgoing administrations. Think about that. If President Obama just passed all of these executive orders And then he knew, well, the Supreme Court, they'll get involved some way, and that's going to enshrine these decrees into law. I mean, no one would have thought that. They were worried, well, he created it by executive decree. That means the next president can come in and just take it away. Not so, says the Supreme Court. So now the perverse incentive is that, well, if you're the outgoing president, you might as well just pass a lot of these orders, and orders that are very earth-shaking. I think it was 2 or 3 million migrants that applied for this, and they had the deferred action, and then they qualified now for government welfare programs. I don't get any of that. I'm an immigrant in the UK, and it says explicitly on the visa that you have no recourse for public funds. You don't get any handouts from the government when you lawfully apply as an immigrant. But if you come over illegally, DACA will give you all those benefits. Thomas says, given this state of affairs, it is unclear to me why the Department of Homeland Security, this is the organization in the executive branch that created DACA under J. Johnson and Barack Obama, so now under Trump, Thomas says, it's unclear to me why the DHS needed to provide any explanation whatsoever when it decided to rescind DACA. Now, everyone's looking at Justice Roberts and saying, what are you doing? This is strange. Well, there's a Pew Research survey that said the majority of Americans were in favor of keeping DACA. So that seems to be Justice Roberts' methodology for how he came to this conclusion. President Trump tweeted, do you get the impression that the Supreme Court doesn't like me? And he's also not giving up on this because now they can go through the whole circus again and he can rewrite the reason for why he feels it's necessary to rescind DACA, and then that has to go back up through the court again. So it could be, I don't know, another year or two before this actually gets sorted out. I wanted to read a couple quotes from Mr. Gerald Fleury's article in the Philadelphia Trumpet. This was back in November, December 2018. He wrote this right after the Kavanaugh confirmation process, that great spectacle. He says, why would controlling the Supreme Court be so important to the devil? Just look what Robert Bork's replacement, Justice Anthony Kennedy, did. He was the deciding vote on several landmark Supreme Court cases that thrust America into deeper immorality. He goes through a couple of these cases that were landmark decisions that made America a more lawless and immoral country, legalizing lawlessness. Mr. Fleury writes, these were decisions that would not have been made law through Congress. These were decisions that would not have been made law through Congress, the governing body that should be making law. In many cases, at least to this point, a majority of Americans have been against the liberal agenda. So liberals have used the courts with approval from the highest court in America. This is how they have forced most of their agenda on the country. That is why they fight so aggressively for control of the courts, even if it means lying and slandering. And then this last quote here, this was further down in the article. He says, Republicans rejoice that Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court. But anyone who thinks the war is won is naive. In many ways, Satan won by losing. His grip on the left got tighter. And victory against the devil is always only temporary. He is relentless. After a loss, he regroups for his next assault. He may lose a battle, but he never quits the war. This probably just made the devil even more angry, seeing that conservative majority on the court. And who knows what's going on behind the scenes there with what drives these justices to make the decisions that they do. I mean, one thing is for certain, those living Constitution justices, the Ginsburgs, the Breyers, they do not waver in their decision-making. They will always be on the radical left progressive agenda. And they don't even try to explain it away using law. Well, they do, but when you get down into it, it's not law. But they don't bend or break. Those four, they will be there. And then you've got these five that are conservative or have the conservative label next to their name. And now you see, well, Justice Roberts, he's not there. He's the new Anthony Kennedy. Brett Kavanaugh might even be there as well. And Gorsuch in that last decision just crossed the line. So again, who knows what's going on there, but it'll be interesting to see again on this decision that's made today about these abortion laws in Louisiana. And it'll be interesting to see just what President Trump does going forward. Any little victory, that was a big victory getting Kavanaugh in there. And that just makes the devil more and more angry, as Mr. Fleury writes. In many ways, Satan won by losing. His grip on the left got tighter. Well, speaking of the radical left, I wanted to get into this story about another advisor on the Trump campaign who was spied on, the fifth one that we now know about for the longest time. Well, in 2016, it was one, then it went up to two, and then three, and then four. And we thought, okay, well, it's four Trump campaign advisors that were spied on. Then we learned about all the people that were unmasked. And the question is, well, who wasn't spied on? And now we have this fifth person who was definitely monitored by the FBI in 2016. And this case flies completely under the radar. This man's name, this advisor, his name is Waleed Fares. He worked for the Trump campaign early on in 2016. He was never in the administration, probably because of all these made-up scandals about him. The FBI investigated him in 2016 the same way it went after Papadopoulos and Flynn and Manafort and Carter Page. And then we get to the special counsel in 2017. Robert Mueller's appointed, and he goes back to look at this man, Waleed Fares. Now, Mueller is supposed to be looking at Russian collusion. He's supposed to be trying to find the plot between Putin and Trump to steal the 2016 election. Waleed Fares, though, has zero to do with Russia. I think he's Egyptian. Or no, I shouldn't say that. I think he was an advisor on Egypt, and he had nothing to do with Russia. And yet here he is being investigated by Obama's FBI and by essentially Obama's special counsel that went into the Trump administration. I want to play this clip for you. This is from Rod Rosenstein's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. This was a couple weeks ago on June 3rd. Rosenstein was responsible for telling Mueller what he was allowed to investigate. So he would write what's called a scope memo. He gives that to Mueller and the 13 angry Democrats and says, this is what you're allowed to investigate. So the public is led to believe, well, he's only supposed to investigate things pertaining to Russia. Well, it so happens that Rosenstein just blows the lid off it and says, look at anything that you can, uncover anything, go everywhere, anywhere. And parts of this memo were redacted. So we knew about the four people that Mueller was allowed to look into, Page and those others. But then there was a fifth that was redacted, and that we now know is this Waleed Fares. But why would Rosenstein allow them to look at him in the first place? Well, like he admits in this clip I'm about to play for you, he didn't even write the memo. He actually let Mueller and the 13 angry Democrats set out their own mission statement. And then all he did was put his name on it because he's the deputy attorney general. Sessions had still recused himself. So Rosenstein's the boss. And all he does throughout the 18 months or whatever that he's there is just looks up at the ceiling with his rubber stamp and doesn't read anything and just signs off on all of it. So Mueller gets to decide, okay, what do I want to look at? And what do you think they're going to look at here? This is that clip of Rosenstein explaining who wrote the memo.
Who provided the information in the memo?
I'm sorry, which memo are we talking
about?
The
one where you lay out the scope of the investigation.
That came through discussions between Mr. Mueller's team and...
Well, did anybody on your team recommend you look at Papadopoulos? Where did the idea that George Papadopoulos working with the Russians came from?
These matters, Senator, were already open when I arrived.
Yeah, the point is that they were open. These are the same people doing Crossfire Hurricane, and they gave you a document to sign. And here's my belief that they prepared the document, that they defined the scope of their own investigation. Is that fair to say? That you were just a conduit for it?
Well, I'm relying on information that's coming up.
Yeah, well, you didn't do an independent investigation yourself, did you?
My job isn't to do the investigation.
No, but you basically relied on what they gave you. Is that fair to say?
Relied on the information that...
Yeah, just like you did with the warrant.
Correct.
Okay, so the same people that gave you the warrant application also gave you the scope investigation for Mueller.
So Rosenstein just stamped it. Mueller and really Weissmann and all of the Democrats there, they got to create their own job description, essentially. And we all paid the bill for that. That was $35, $40 million for them to go run around and try to dig up anything they could on President Trump. Rod Rubber Stamp Rosenstein, that's what he did. He did not look into anything. He just pleads ignorance. It's not my job to ask questions. I have to trust the people under me that they do the job and they bring me these things and I just sign off on it. Not even remotely skeptical. Well, that's just gross negligence, which is illegal, and he should be just ousted from ever having a position in the future. But of course, he'll probably get a job with CNN or MSNBC. I wanted to go through this New York Times piece because this was the big revelation about this fifth person who was spied on, and it hasn't received a lot of attention because there's so little that's known about it. And usually you have to remember that if you see it first in the New York Times or the Washington Post, it's because they're getting ready for something to come out and they need, somebody leaked it and they've got to get the spin. They've got to get ahead of the big release. So they have to get their spin on it. So they leak it to the Times or the Washington Post. Remember that. And remember that the FBI is supposed to be investigating Russian collusion. This is the title of this article from May 28th, New York Times. FBI once investigated Trump campaign advisors' ties to Egypt. What is going on now? This isn't Russian collusion. The FBI and the special counsel's office investigated whether a former Trump campaign advisor secretly worked for the Egyptian government to influence the incoming administration in the months before President Trump took office. We're on to Egypt Trump collusion. It does not stop. And we're going to see as we get to the end of this segment and further revelations that come out in the coming weeks and months that this didn't have anything to do with Russian collusion. Most of that is a cover story, and that is a mask for all of these things that they were looking at under the scenes. They just needed an excuse, a cover story to sell to the public. And then they could go on and do all of their dirty work underneath the surface. They're looking for anything and everything. The New York Times goes on here. And it says, the former advisor, Walid Fares, was one of five Trump campaign aides investigated over their ties to foreign countries. The decision to investigate Mr. Fares was based on highly classified information, the People said. Another one of the New York Times' great sources, the People. Investigators examined the matter for months, but ultimately brought no charges. Brent Noctegal is also looking into this because this just carries you right into the Middle East. At the time, you've got President El-Sisi of Egypt, and he is no friend of Barack Obama because he came in after the Muslim Brotherhood leader was ousted. I think that was Morsi. President Obama loved the Muslim Brotherhood and did not get along with Sisi at all. So he's there now, has eyes and ears on this Trump campaign advisor who's friends with the president of Egypt, is working on relations with the between the United States and the president of Egypt. And, well, he's from a foreign country, so now he needs to be investigated because there's collusion everywhere. For months, he was investigated for months, but ultimately brought no charges. Well, why would that be? Why would you bring charges? Well, you have to announce charges. That's a very public thing. If the U.S. government is doing that, it needs to be announced. Why would you want to draw attention to that? Why not just investigate? You get your 5-6 months of spying, find out, listen to anyone that you need to, remotely connected to this man, and then just walk away from it. Well, they already had the four other scalps. Why try to take him out? And then this highly classified information that was the predicate for investigating him, there's a lot of talk out there that that was just another dirty dossier, another steal concoction. I don't know if it was Steele himself or if it was someone in Egypt. We know that in Ukraine, there were politicians that created one for Paul Manafort. You can look into the Black Ledger. They just fabricated the evidence, and then they leak it to someone in the U.S. media, Nadler or Schiff or whoever sees it and says, well, we got to investigate this guy. And that's how the spin cycle goes. The New York Times says Waleed and those others elicited concerns at the FBI because of their overseas contacts and the possibility that a variety of foreign governments might have been trying to secretly use the advisors to advance their agendas, as if that doesn't happen all the time. The CIA director at the time, Mike Pompeo, was briefed on the investigation, suggesting that the agency might have obtained a tip from an Egyptian source that prompted the FBI inquiry. I think something is out of order with how they're doing that. There's the FBI investigation of him in 2016, and then the Mueller investigation where they revisit him in 2017. And then that would have been while Pompeo was over the CIA there briefly. They began examining Mr. Ferez's ties to Egypt as part of that 2016 investigation. Now, Mr. Ferez, like I said, he is no friend of the Obama administration. He's very critical of the Iran deal. He's very critical of the Muslim Brotherhood. He frequently appears on Fox News to talk about the dangers of Islamic terrorism and Sharia law. So you could see the hostility here. You could see the Obama administration fixated on, one, making sure Donald Trump does not succeed, and two, ensuring that their foreign policy survives. And Obama practically worshipped that Iran deal. There was nothing he wouldn't do to ensure that it survived. And if it meant spying on a member of the opposing campaign who is also a member of the media, so be it. The New York Times writes, hints of the investigation into Mr. Ferez have emerged in redacted special counsel documents and in FBI interview notes obtained by BuzzFeed News in an open records lawsuit. CNN also sued for the records, so more of this should be coming out soon. I'll just read a few more quotes from here. Now, Waleed Ferez, he worked closely with Sam Clovis, who was another man that was targeted by the Obama FBI, and it was really someone who tried to plant himself into the campaign so that he could create collusion. This Waleed Ferez, he's coming out and he's speaking out more. He did an interview with John Solomon on his blog site, Just the News. Solomon writes, for more than 2 years now, Waleed Ferez has kept a secret. The national security expert, favored by many conservatives, was interviewed and investigated in the Russia collusion probe, mostly for an issue unrelated to Moscow. It was Egypt, actually. The allegation, like many in the Russia case, turned out to be spurious, and Ferez was never charged with wrongdoing by special counsel Robert Mueller's team. Now Fares is speaking out for the first time, suggesting that one of the motives of those who made the allegations and sustained the investigation was to hamper the early Trump presidency's foreign policy goals, including the 45th president's long-promised plan to cancel the Obama-era Iran nuclear deal. Think of that. Think of these advisors coming onto the campaign, and they're all being monitored. Now, a lot of he's probably, I'd say, the highest profile one when you get into the area of familiar faces or media faces. No one knew who Carter Page or George Papadopoulos was. Obviously, Manafort and Flynn were more well known. Fares told Solomon, "In my view, the push against the Trump campaign and then the transition and then the administration was on behalf of those who wanted to defend the Iran deal, to protect the interests of the Iran deal." So now you have this little tangent here. You've got go after Donald Trump at all costs, bring him down any way you can. Goal number one is to take him out. If we can take him out, we don't have to worry about all these other things. But now that he's in, let's do anything and everything we can to thwart his foreign policy objectives. And they have eyes and ears now on the advisors who would be key to making those decisions. And none of these men made it into the Trump presidency. Flynn lasted, I want to say, 3 weeks, February 24th, a little over 4 weeks. He's the only one. Page was gone. Papadopoulos is gone. Manafort is gone. Waleed Fares is gone. And Flynn made it 4 weeks. Flynn and Fares probably would have been the two primary proponents of scrapping that Iran deal. So Obama certainly did not want them in any position to influence foreign policy. So Fares is monitored in 2016. Then a year later, this is from Solomon, Fares suddenly got a knock on his door from FBI agents working for Mueller's probe. He was questioned several times by agents and prosecutors, as well as by House and Senate investigators, and nothing more ever came of it. Multiple sources with direct knowledge told Just the News that U.S. intelligence during the Obama-Trump transition received allegations suggesting Fares might have accepted money or been acting as an unregistered lobbyist for Egyptians trying to gain influence with Trump. The uncorroborated allegations were eventually put into the scope memo signed in August 2017 by then-Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein that set the parameters for the work that Mueller's team was to accomplish. And like I said, Rosenstein didn't write that. Mueller came in and wrote that. So someone was giving that to the 13 angry Democrats. They said, drop this in the memo. Let's go monitor Fares as well. Just throw that in there with the lot. And this is more than likely just another dossier. In that highly classified intelligence, it says that Waleed Fares had a meeting in Seychelles with officials. And he says, I've never been there. It's just like, who was it? Cohn and the Prague visit, that never happened. That was part of the dossier. And that was when the Washington Post sent over all of those reporters going to hotels in Prague to find out if Cohen ever visited this city. And it was just completely made up. Fares says, I was never in Seychelles. Why? Where did that come from? It's just another dossier, another made up thing. Continuing on here from Solomon's article, former House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, who played a central role in unraveling the false Russia collusion narrative, says he believes Fares was set up by false allegations simply to sideline him like other early Trump advisors. I can say with 100% certainty that Waleed Fares was targeted for a political dirty trick, just like we saw with so many other people in the Russia collusion hoax, Nunes told John Solomon. And he's seen the documents, and he's been proven right time and time again. And he says, I'm 100% certain this was a dirty political trick. New York Times is just trying to get ahead of it, probably before Durham does. Ferez said this to Solomon, "You know, as an American citizen, seeing those exchanges, it kind of shocks me," he said. "We live in a liberal democracy, but it elevates my suspicion that there is something at a higher level that was happening. Because to stop a president, I mean, this is something that in our American history we haven't seen before. An unprecedented attack on the United States of America, an unprecedented attack on democracy and on President Trump." I can use that there to transition into this final segment here. I wanted to talk about Barack Obama's community organizing skills, his influence over the Black Lives Matter movement. This book by Saul Alinsky, it's titled Rules for Radicals. And the reason I wanted to go through this and just read some quotes for you here is because I think it does help you understand how really how the mob thinks and how it operates. We have to remember, first and foremost, that Barack Obama is not president of the United States. First and foremost, he's a community organizer, and that's really been the only job that he'd held until he was a state senator. I think he taught at the University of Chicago, but he was a community organizer in Chicago in the 80s. I think he did some in New York City, and those are his roots. In this book by Saul Alinsky, it's titled Rules for Radicals, and Alinsky is responsible for creating problems in poor areas and organizing people to revolt, essentially. And he's a very twisted man. He doesn't say what his motives are aside from we need power to create equality. It always is for the great goal of equality. I wanted to play this clip for you from A Key of David from back in 2012. And I think this is even before America Under Attack was published. And Mr. Gerald Fleury here is talking about deception. He's talking about lies. And he reads this quote here from Alinsky. And Alinsky, again, Obama didn't have a direct relationship with him, but Alinsky influenced that entire community organizing community in the south side of Chicago. So all of his methodology, his practices are there. You even hear the scholars and politicians like Ocasio-Cortez, I think they inadvertently quote from his book. I don't think they realize that they very often directly quote from his book, but they've tried to distance themselves from him because of how radical he is. And he was organizing primarily in the 1960s. But I want to play this clip now for you from this 2012 Key of David.
Look at this quote. In the book Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky wrote that in order to persuade people, you don't need facts. All you need to do is fix, frame, and personalize the issue, hammering away at it until you convince people. That's what Satan does. He's going to accuse me, and he'll accuse you, and accuse everybody else, do all he can do, and just keep attacking. And he can't convince anybody with the facts, but if he takes this approach, just keep hammering home, just accusing and attacking personalities and demonizing people. And pretty soon, a lot of people will believe you because they're so easily deceived.
Tell the lie. Tell it over and over and over and over again. Get more people to tell the lie. Keep hammering it home. And eventually, people will believe you. It's the War of the Wills article, if you haven't read that. You can look back at the War of the Wills article. You can look at America Under Attack. This is a quote from the Chicago Sun-Times. It's on the back cover of this book, Rules for Radicals. It says, Alinsky's techniques and teachings influenced generations of community and labor organizers, including the church-based group hiring a young Barack Obama to work on Chicago's South Side in the 1980s. Alinsky impressed a young Hillary Clinton who was growing up in Park Ridge at the time. At the time, Alinsky was the director of the Industrial Areas Foundation in Chicago. So it goes to him, this methodology. And Hillary Clinton, I think she wrote her doctoral thesis paper on Alinsky. I can't remember what college she was at, but she definitely wrote this paper about him, and she has not released that. She doesn't want anybody to see that paper. So they're all closely knit group there. Alinsky talks about how you have to work within the system. He says any revolutionary change must be preceded by a passive, affirmative, non-challenging attitude toward change among the mass of our people. Now keep these quotes in mind as we go through this. Keep the Black Lives Matter movement in mind. Bear in mind that they visited Barack Obama in the White House, the leaders of this group. He invited them right into the White House. You know, who's going to stand up to the mob? It's a moral movement. Who could disagree with Black Lives Matter? If you disagree with that statement, you are a racist. So what they need is for people to be passive and non-challenging. Alinsky says, a revolutionary organizer must shake up the prevailing patterns of their lives. This is there as in the middle class. Agitate, create disenchantment and discontent with the current values to produce, if not a passion for change, at least a passive, affirmative, non-challenging climate. Create the problem and then get people to just, you know, they don't necessarily have to be out on the streets rioting. They just have to not stand up to them. They just have to allow it to happen. And one way you don't stand up to them is, well, you just do what they say. If I get to keep my job and it means I just post these black squares and I kneel, well, okay, the movement can move on and do their thing and I won't stand up to them. They won't act for change, but won't strongly oppose those who do. The time is then ripe for revolution. You get the average person to a point where they will not stand up to them. And then he gives his goal here. My aim, Alinsky writes, is to suggest how to organize for power, how to get it, and to use it. I will argue that the failure to use power for a more equitable distribution of the means of life for all people signals the end of the revolution and the start of the counter-revolution. Essentially, if you're holding on to power and you're not using that to create equality, then a revolution is necessary. And that's right out of the Communist Manifesto. And of course, it sounds so nice. We want power so we can create equality. Because every time these movements get into power, they treat everybody so fairly. You look at the Soviet Union and see how fairly people were treated. You look at today and the way this movement treats people. It is not fair. There's a double standard. There's one law for you and one law for me. But they get to power because they talk about how sympathetic they are and how tolerant they are and how equitable they are and how they just want power to do what's right for you. That's probably exactly what the devil probably said to the demons. Well, if you just rebel, you can have everything that I have. We'll share everything. Again, Alinsky says, an organizer working in and for an open society is in an ideological dilemma. To begin with, he does not have a fixed truth. Truth to him is relative and changing. Everything to him is relative and changing. He is a political relativist. Now, the rules are always changing. Can you keep up with the radical left? Can you keep up with the latest practice that you're supposed to do to atone for the sins that you didn't commit? Can you keep up with the movement? I was thinking about this the other day, and it was like 10, 15 years ago when I was in public school. The big push was multiculturalism, and we celebrate other people's cultures because that will bring unity. And again, that's a total failure, but that was what the left really pushes. And then 5, 6 years ago, suddenly it's cultural appropriation. How dare you celebrate someone else's culture? You stick to yours. And if you take someone else's, well, that's racist. You can't keep up with that. You can't reason with people who think that way. It's all relative. And what they're doing is they're just taking advantage of whatever sentiment is there. They're just preying on it, and then they move. They use that relativism to power through their agenda. It's the same with the Me Too movement. You take down everybody in 2017, and then all these prominent Democrats get scooped up in it as well. Well, we've moved on from that. We need due process now. Believe all women. That worked in 2017 and 2018 against Kavanaugh, but 2019 and 2020 with the allegation against Democrats, we need due process. One law for you, one law for me. Alinsky says, we live with a Judeo-Christian ethic that has not only accommodated itself, to, but justified slavery, war, and every other ugly human exploitation of whichever status quo happened to prevail. It's the Judeo-Christian ethic that accommodates and justifies slavery and war. That is what he writes. And who do you hear saying that today? It's the United States and Britain that are at fault. Richard Palmer talked about that last week. How is it that you get to this point where the United States and Britain, the two countries responsible for obliterating slavery, are the ones that are supposed to pay the penalty for millennia of slavery? He calls the middle class part of our racist, discriminatory culture. One of the rules of ethics and of the ethics of means and ends is that you do what you can with what you have and clothe it with moral garments. Just talk about morality. Just talk about how evil the other side is. He writes, but to the organizer, compromise is a key and beautiful word. It is always present in the pragmatics of operation. It is making the deal, getting that vital breather, usually the victory. If you start with nothing, demand 100%, then compromise for 30%, you're 30% ahead. Think of that movement, the BLM movement, over the last 10 years. You've got Kaepernick kneeling 3 to 4 years ago. A lot of people don't like it. He's silenced, but he brought attention to the movement. He gets his breather. 4 years later, you've got the entire world practically kneeling. You have entire Premier League teams kneeling. And they just keep compromising. They compromised with the conservatives, compromised with the Confederate statues. Okay, well, you just take those down. I can see why you'd want those, but don't touch Jefferson and Washington. And sure enough, they're pulling all of those down. And what's the excuse going to be again? They love compromise. He writes, Alinsky does, before men can act, an issue must be polarized. Men will act when they are convinced that their cause is 100% on the side of the angels and that the opposition are 100% on the side of the devil. He knows that there can be no action until issues are polarized to this degree. And what is happening in the United States is exactly that. Now, you do need to look at issues in black and white. You have to look at issues as good and evil. But what he's doing is he's taking that lie that he wrote about at the beginning of the book, and he's saying, if you don't agree with the lie, you are a racist. There's no other position you can be. If you don't kneel to the mob, you are clearly a racist. And he knows that that's not true, but he knows what it does to the country. He knows how it offends and upsets people. He knows how it creates division so that he can get the revolution. He writes, the organizer's job is to inseminate an invitation for himself to agitate, introduce ideas, get people pregnant with hope and desire for change, and to identify you as the person most qualified for this purpose. Remember the Hope and Change campaign? Remember the hero? Remember the savior that would end racism? Alinsky says, change comes from power, and power comes from organization. The first step in community organization is community disorganization. The organizer dedicated to changing the life of a particular community must first rub raw the resentments of the people of the community, fan the latent hostilities of many of the people to the point of overt expression. An organizer must stir up dissatisfaction and discontent. He dramatizes the injustices. In the beginning, the organizer's first job is to create the issues or problems. Another rule, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. Just create the issue, create the problem, and you can apply that to this movement. You can do that on your own. You can look at the news and you can see exactly what they're trying to do. And Saul Alinsky, he gives us the connection right to the source of all of this. He dedicates his book. Literally in the acknowledgement section is a note to Lucifer, praising him as the first community organizer who earned his own kingdom. How horrendous is that? How twisted is that? And this book, they won't openly admit it, but it forms the basis of a lot of what they do, a lot of the practical applications behind these movements. Well, I am out of time for today. That is a sad note to end on. Well, not sad, but maybe not as positive, but at least we can be thankful that we have the truth, that we know what's behind it, that we know what God is doing for our nations, and that he's exposing this. He's going to expose this for people to see and for them to choose. So if you haven't, you can go through and read America Under Attack and Great Again. They cover a lot of this material as well. Thank you for joining us today. If you have any emails or comments, you can send those to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us.